Hey there, and welcome to episode number 34 of Become a Guitarist Today with myself, Adam Roach. Now, in this episode, I am joined by a very special guest. I talk to the one and only multimillionaire, astronaut, speaker, or as I know him, guitar teacher and rock star, Mr. Nick Halleck. Now, Nick was actually my guitar teacher back in about 1991, 92. He used to play in a band called Big Deal. And before he'd go to his gig, he used to come teach me. And that's where I pretty much learned all my little rock tricks and other things that really influenced my playing today. So I thank Nick a lot for what he has done. So in this podcast, we actually talk about when he very first started. We also talk about his time at GIT, how he used all his teaching money and performing to invest into where he is today, which is the multimillionaire. Nick also gives us some great tips on how he actually got to where he is today and all about the music industry. He also reflects on some of his examples from his new book called The 5-Day Weekend, which I'm lucky to have a copy of. Nick sent me a copy and I've just finished reading the book, and I must say it's probably the first book that I've actually read from start to finish and has made a huge impact on my life of the ways of living. So I do highly recommend this book for anyone wanting to get more out of life by freeing up time and having more time, even just to practice guitar and doing what you love to do. And we also talk about his new TV show that he's filming at the moment, which really looks and sounds amazing. I've seen little snippets of it and it's going to be incredible. So look out for this one. Now, throughout this podcast, you actually hear some of Nick's playing. Now, what I've done, I've actually found an old cassette tape of Nick demonstrating some exercises to me in the key of D major. So I've taken his playing from the cassette tape, so the quality's not the best, but I've put in some backing music behind it, so just some guitar, bass, and a bit of percussion. So let's go over to the interview now with Nick Halleck.
Hey, hello.
How you doing? How are you?
Good, how are you, mate? Well, actually, first of all, I want to say thank you for the years that you taught me back in those days.
Yeah, indeed. That's some time ago now. What are we, how many years are we talking about now?
It would have been, 1991, somewhere around there, I think.
Wow. I think. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's like, dude, that's like 27 years.
I know.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. So, if we can get started on when you first started playing and your influences, like why you started, who influenced you to start playing?
Yeah, definitely. The real spark of inspiration and imagination, I guess, was around age 11, seeing some old Woodstock footage. Jimi Hendrix, I was there with my brother watching it on television.
Yeah.
But I thought it was like really, really, really cool, I guess, kind of thing, you know. So there's a bit of a backstory to this, because originally I wanted to become an astronaut.
Yep.
You know, so with failing eyesight, failing at maths, and just, a whole bunch of health condition, whatever, too. My father sort of sent me down and goes, well, you know what, son? You won't be an astronaut. You can't be an astronaut. So you need to choose another vocation, you know? And I figured, well, if you can't be an astronaut, the next coolest thing is become a guitarist, right?
Yeah.
All these ambitions, become an astronaut, straight to guitar. And that basically became my my full-time gig from that particular point on, you know? So age 11 onwards, most of my 20s and most of my early 30s, I pretty much just spent, rock bands, touring around the world, getting signed to a record label and just becoming a big session player in Australia and here in the United States. And it's funny enough, because my original dreams of of becoming an astronaut, it's a full 360, because after I left the music industry, I went to Russia and I joined the Russian Orbital Space Program. And after a number of years, I got qualified and certified as Australia's first civilian astronaut. Right. So I went from cutting all my hair, long hair, putting my guitar down for almost like a decade, to fulfilling my astronaut ambition, all because I wrote down my top 10 list of goals when I was a young kid, I guess, kind of thing. So it's kind of weird, man. It's how it all basically sort of transpired, I guess.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you studied at the GIT as well, didn't you?
Yeah, so I went to GIT when I was about just before my 18th birthday. I bought a one-way ticket from Melbourne at age 17. I finished high school, got into university, permanently deferred, never turned up, and attended GIT. It was probably the best time ever, because all my mentors, like in guitar world or guitar player, we're all basically teaching at GIT. And this is like 1988, where all the shredders were. Like, they're all Mike Varney shredders, from from Paul Gilbert to Bruce Bollé to Steve Vai. I mean, they were all there.
Mm.
That wisdom of just being, that transmission of just being inspired, I guess. And I think my playing, when I left GIT, I was a different player. I was more modal, way more melodic over here, better phrasing, better ideas. I can script, I can put songs together. So I became more of a rounded musician, I guess, kind of thing. And at GIT, those couple of years were phenomenal because there was this 24-hour ecosystem. If you want the leading bass players, you go to the bass department. If you want a great percussionist, drummer, if you want a vocalist, they were all there.
Yep.
And it was like 500 of the best musicians in the world. Yep. And there were performances every night. I mean, I was probably spending about, 15 hours a day there. Mm-hmm. I would go home to sleep for 5 hours, then back to GIT. It was just phenomenal, man.
Yeah.
It was the coolest experience. And it was good because it was in my teenage years. You know, when you're very impressionable as a player, because as you mature as guitarists, you become very set in your ways and your style of playing, I guess.
Mm.
So, having this great drive and ambition, I also had a fairly significant skill set, skill-wise, but to have it fine-tuned and streamlined, it was probably one of the best experiences by far.
Yeah, because I've interviewed a couple of people, like Jennifer Batten, from Michael Jackson's band.
Yeah,
and
she was GIT
yeah,
in 1985.
That's right, and Frank Gambale as well, interviewed last week.
Yeah, he was GIT once again.
Yeah, so with Jennifer, she was saying that she had to audition for it, but with Frank, he said he didn't because he's from Australia, pretty much just got in. Is that the same with you?
No, I had to audition.
Oh, okay.
I remember what it was because I needed about, I think it was about 10 grand for the tuition.
Yep.
So my parents had a convenience business in Tasmania. So like I went down there for 6 months, worked my ass off, and basically, with that and the proceeds of my first music business that I sold, I was able to move to California with about $30,000 just after finishing high school. But I remember doing an audition tape. I actually did it on my acoustic guitar because I sort of figured, well, if I can impress them with my acoustic guitar, like a steel string, then I'm sure that, that should pretty much seal the deal.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't going to put have my electric guitar with compression pedals, a T-Snider or an OD1 or a HS1 heavy metal pedal kind of thing. It was just this clean acoustic steel string, and I was doing all this Aldi Miola type thing, The real pick and And so that was my audition thing, man. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah. So it's from there, was it 2 years that you did as GIT?
Well, what I did was because the absorption rate was so significant, what I did was I did 6 months and then I basically paused it and then went back the following year because I wanted to take all the things that I absorbed in those 6 months. I took about 8 months timer and I lived in America just so I can hone in and lock in what I just learned.
Yep.
And then I went back in again. And I thought it was probably a smarter way to do it because in 1 year, I mean, the absorption rate, the knowledge and just the skill set, you need to go away, internalize it, and then come back into it.
Mm.
And I feel if you didn't have time to internalize it, a lot of it, you're just going to overlook and just completely miss.
Yeah, that's a good way of doing
it. So I did it in 1998 and I completed it in 1990, which was pretty awesome, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then after that, that's when you come back and did the clinics where I first saw you.
Yeah, so then I came back to Australia, did a whole bunch of guitar clinics all around Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't really anybody doing that kind of stuff back then,
Yeah.
But we're pretty crazy. We did a lot of cool guitar clinics. And then from there, did a lot of session work, joined a couple of bands, some original bands. And, you know what the Australian music scene's like.
Yeah.
It's not really an original scene. In order to generate an income, you've got to incorporate the other top 40 element.
Yep.
And that's pretty much Australia. In America, it's more of like a pay to play. If you're an original act, you have to pay to play at a certain time, and then you're going to go out there and sell tickets for people to come to see you in order to recoup back your money back and keep on scaling up and playing a later at night to attract a bigger audience kind of thing until you're able to attract a significant A&R individual for the record labels. But back then, I mean, we eventually got signed up.
Yeah.
But the music industry was very, very different back then compared to what it is now.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
I mean, it's gone through these revolutions, from the late 1990s where there wasn't any web presence because this is pre-web, this is pre laptops, you know. I mean, for now, it's just pretty much word of mouth. You're bursting CDs, putting a backpack, and going to the venue and just out to your fans, you know.
Yeah.
And then we had the 2000s, which was very much the MySpace era for, like, musicians. And obviously then we got Facebook, you know, from 2004 onwards. And now you've got social media and Twitter where you can also release your music on iTunes without needing an A&R. So music has just undergone this massive, massive evolution compared to how we originally did it back in the early days kind of thing. But you know what? It was most, probably the most phenomenal time of my life. Nothing beats creating and entertaining as opposed to being entertained.
Yeah.
But for the viewers that's listening, you get it. You just get it. Yeah. Once you dial into that particular frequency, I guess, you know.
Oh, for sure. Oh, I mean, we're privileged enough to play with you guys. Was it New Holland?
You know what? Yes. New Holland, my God. That's the Royal Derby.
That's right. Yeah, that's where we played with you guys. We supported you with Eclipse.
That's right. Wow, geez. 1991.
Yeah. There you go.
1991. That's crazy, man.
Yeah, because I remember I was rapping, you know, at that time I was taking lessons with you and then getting the chance to play with your original band. It was amazing.
Yeah. I remember I had the first Soldano in Australia, the amp.
Oh, really?
I had the first Tom Anderson guitar, the first Soldano amp. Uh-huh. I had this modified Soldano amp built by Mike Soldano, which was probably like the closest head to like Van Halen 2.
Yeah.
You know, that nice crunch brown sound of the Van Halen 2 album kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that Soldano just screamed. But a lot of fun memories, man. But, you know, the music scene in Australia back then was far more vibrant. And then one by one, all those venues started to, like, close down to the poke industry, you know, from even, like, New York House, like the Bundy's, you know.
That's right, yeah.
To, like, you know, to the Manhattan, to the Royal Derby, to all those places, just one by one, they just closed down. It was like this chokehold on the Melbourne pub scene. And that's why I've always said, like, Melbourne bands in particular have always been the best live acts in the world because they've been in the trenches with the live music, where a lot of bands overseas, they didn't do the pub scene, for example. They were just basically, you know, sending their demo tape. Mm. They get signed into a studio. Then they have to learn how to perform once they're out there to sell the album.
Yep.
You know, where Australians, we've done it, we've done it RSN, I guess, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Where we develop a live act. It's undergone so many revolutions, man. It's like, but, you know, and as you know, too, I've been actually out of the industry now for a decade. But it got to the point where just I need to resurface and aerate and, you know, ventilate the soul. And then I pivoted to other elements, like, you know, business, entrepreneurial stuff. You know, I do a lot of advisory. I'm an angel investor for a lot of tech startups here in the United States. And but I still have my guitar. I still rock.
Oh, really?
I still perform.
Yeah.
I still write songs. I've got a pretty cool studio.
Oh, wow.
And it's still part of me. It's like my style has changed once again.
Yep.
It's undergone like a metamorphosis.
Yeah.
It's changed again. But I've got demos of, like, you know, when I was 12, in my 20s. I've got demos in my 30s. It's just awesome to, like, see the progression, I guess, where you've come from, your origins, you know, the sound. You know, what you considered to be a great sound back then. A lot of funny stories, man.
Yeah. Well, now with, like, the fractal audio, things like that, you know, heaps of different effects. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's like, you know, everybody's got their own studio these days in their house, you know. Even recordings undergone, like, a massive, massive shift as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So do you think you ever release any of your material? Or just,
you know what? Time? I've got so many songs that I've written. So many songs that we've actually recorded too. But, you know, I think now where I'm at, I would rather produce other acts because I've got the ideas, I've got the songs, I've got the hooks. Yeah, I would rather produce acts and, you know, pre-produce as opposed to getting on stage. And I think, I mean, you do it for the love of it. I'm on a book launch right now.
Yep.
My book, The 5-Day Weekend, is out in about 4 weeks' time. So I'm just doing a big national tour here in the United States.
Okay.
And at the same time, we're also, you know, filming a TV show. So I've got so many other parts within the entertainment industry that I'm actually involved in.
Yeah,
but for me to get back on stage, I would rather produce behind the scenes.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, fair enough. Actually, talking about books, So I got this, your first book.
Ah, The Three Good Airmen.
Yeah.
Well, that came out 11 years ago, 2007. Yeah, that book was written in like so many different countries, man.
Oh, really?
That's that was a fun book to write. Yeah, just one of those books. But I still get emails from individuals how that book has just impacted their mindset and their lives and what they do and how they sort of excavate their life's purpose, I guess, kind of thing. You know? But
yeah.
It brings back a lot of memories, man.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about on page 60, you had a little quote here saying,
"Yes,
when you talk about your teaching, some of these students would later become professional guitarists and launch their own musical
careers.
So is that me?
Absolutely, yeah. No, definitely, man. I mean, I probably taught, I would say probably over 400 or 500 different guitarists. And obviously you had your those who treat it as a hobby, those who treat it far more professionally. Because I saw a void in the marketplace, I saw a particular niche, and there was a lot of players that didn't really understand the music element about guitar solo. Because as we know, in the 80s, it was all guitar solos.
Yeah.
You know, up until about 1992, then it became more of a rhythmic type musical theme kind of thing. And guitar solos were sort of frowned upon, you know. And it became almost like a very niche market of those who were just the guitar soloists.
Yep.
And, you know, they had vibrant markets in Russia, Ukraine, and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
They were the leading markets for the shredders, those who managed to survive the grunge. Because I think you need a grunge because the sound in the 80s became overly processed and it just lost that raw, organic sound.
Mm-hmm.
So thank God for grunge that totally just really just changed. Basically, it was just this massive dynamic shift, I guess. But off the back of that, we lost sight of the guitar, knowing how to guitar solo. And you notice that like throughout the late 1990s, all the guitarists sort of came out, they weren't soloists. They were just rhythm players.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, music's undergone this particular shift. Because I grew up in the days of like shredding. I mean, you know, from early Ozzy Osbourne albums to Gary Moore to Yngwie Malmsteen to like, even to like, you know, early Van Halen back in 1981, you know. And then Van Halen finally peaked in about 1983. And then you had other players, you know. So when you look at the transition of music, you have, to me, you've got Hendrix.
Yeah.
Then you had Van Halen. Then you've had Yngwie Malmsteen, and then you've had Satriani. And I think those four players in guitar history by far had transformed the instrument as far as we know it, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, no, very true.
But it's amazing we've gone through those cycles through the different decades. And now it's come back to, if you want to look at Tony Bonamassa, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I still like Eric Johnson.
Yep.
You know, Sean Lane was phenomenal in the early 1990s as an underground guitarist kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there really isn't too many guitarists who sort of stand out, who've got their own definitive style.
Yep.
Like their own predicate of phrasing, for example. Because a lot of guitarists, it's just one big regurgitated script. And it's the same 12 notes, but they're phrasing it the same way, like either Bai or Satriani did, I guess, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's probably the main thing I learned from you, I guess. I've still got my books here. All the modal things.
I see the Van Halen scratch in the back there.
Yeah, the paint job. just learning all those modes, which I don't think many people do anymore. Like you were saying,
no, definitely not.
Yeah
definitely not. A lot of guitarists these days, I think they, first of all, I noticed that a lot of guitarists don't even know how to tune a guitar. I mean, they've got these electronic tuners they put in the headstock, and I mean, for me, I know what 440 is. I can even tell you what 430 is. I can tune my guitar to 430 or 440, depending on if I'm doing drop D. I can tune my guitar just to the open strings. And I'm pretty precise because when I was doing guitar, I had to transcribe from an album, you know? And I recall my parents had a Marantz stereo. And this Marantz had one of the most miraculous features that you could actually record it on fast and then drop it down one octave below, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So I remember transcribing Eruption. Van Halen's Eruption from 1978. I transcribed it in 1981, man.
Oh, wow.
It was freaky. I learned to develop my ear, where I find a lot of guitarists these days haven't developed their ear at all.
Yep.
So if you can't develop your ear in relation to perfect pitch, then you probably have a lack of understanding about different modes and how to apply different modes to different chordal structures.
Yep.
Whether you're jamming like on a sharp four, like an Alinean, or a flat 7-sharp 5, like with a mixolydian or something, or whether it's in a minor key or a major key, or even like a pentatonic, or knowing how to see, you understand a really good guitarist when you can hear him solo and you can actually hear the chords change,
yep.
you know, as he starts to play, you know, just playing notes, but you can actually visualize the chordal structure behind the notes that he's playing. That's how you tell a player that works within the modes. A lot of individuals, they have no idea what particular key to solo in.
Yeah.
I think the 1990s is to blame for that.
Yeah.
Because I feel guitar was getting, like music, the skill set and the theoretical components, understanding theory, it was phenomenal because now you have this whole generation of players wanting to learn how to understand theory. Mm. And then tablature came out, you know? When I first started, I mean, tablature wasn't even invented, it wasn't even created
yeah.
until like about 1984. But back then it was like, I had to learn how to read music. And I did a whole bunch, I did about 4 years of classical guitar training just so I could learn how to read music.
Mm.
And I think that also helped me with understanding triads and intervals and music and sort of putting it all together kind of thing, you know? But I can't keep chatting about the evolution of guitar and music, you know? It's just it's constantly shifting, man.
Yeah,
but it's going to loop back into guitar. It's going to loop back to the guitar heroes, man.
Yeah. So is there any new artists or anything out now that you like to listen to?
You know what? I still do this. I just basically, my favorite app is Pandora. I put in my favorite guitarist.
Yep.
And it just basically loops in every song of that particular guitarist.
Okay.
Whether we're in a mood for like Eric Johnson or Stevie Ray or Shawn Lane
mm.
or Vai. Or even like Gary Moore. I mean, I grew up on early Gary Moore.
Yep.
Way, way, way before it became... Before he became mainstream, I guess, you know? I mean, you know, Gary Moore was like, I mean, back in those days, it was like one of my favorite albums was the End of the World album, you know?
Yep.
And, you know, even like Jeff Beck, mm. back in those days, even like Hendrix, you know, Axel Bold as Love, mm. even like Page when he was under the influence of drugs,
mm.
you know? And I love artists like, and I love Radiohead, I love The Verb, I love, actually just, I love good, strong melody, good, strong hooks, you know?
Yep.
And I'll always put up a track, even though that song doesn't have a guitar solo, I will still jam to a song that has a really good melodic structure to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I just got to talent it.
Yeah, for sure. So pretty much after, I know you said this before, but after like the days here, you know, gave up the music altogether. So you never really touched the guitar after that? Or you still played a little bit?
Well, the year 2000 was my last gig. I was at the Corner Hotel in Richmond in Melbourne, Australia.
Yep.
I knew that was it. Part of the hard thing was because 85% of what I've generated in the music industry, from merchandise to royalties to jamming to like session work to, you know, I was investing that in the real estate.
Mm.
And the financial markets. So I set up myself, I was generating passive income. And, you know, I worked my ass off too. And I was teaching guitar too, on top of that. I was generating some good coin. And I reached a point where I had reached a 2-to-1 ratio in relation to my income, I guess. And so I left the music industry, took a 2-year sabbatical of my life, and didn't touch the guitar for 2 years. And it literally took me about 10 years to pick it up again. I always planned to get back into music.
Yeah.
But it had to be back on my terms because I did music for so long professionally, like every day, every day, every day, hours and hours and hours of practice. It just consumed my life. And I sacrificed a lot of my life for music. So I needed a good break. And it was a healthy break because I was able to aerate and ventilate my ideas, my soul kind of thing. And I wanted to come back to it at the right timing in my life.
Yeah.
But I think it's important. Sometimes you got to walk away and... you know, come back to it because if you're in it and if it feels like a job, you're doing it by necessity. Do whatever it takes to survive. But if you're doing it because you love it, it's a passion.
Yep.
You know, it got to the point where towards the late 1990s, I was no longer passionate. You know, I would go up on stage. I mean, it was great on stage, you know, jamming out kind of thing. The moment I got up, I just wanted to get the hell off the stage.
Yeah.
You know, and I found myself in that particular predicament. You know, other individuals, musos, will self-medicate, I guess.
Mm.
You know, that was never my style.
Yep.
I mean, I would drink in moderation, but I would never medicate and do drugs kind of thing. I mean, I think life's too valuable, you know, to go down that route kind of thing, which is, you know, it's the abyss. And you see phenomenal musicians dying, whether it's drugs or just suicide. I mean, one of my favorite artists, Chris Cornell, you know?
Yeah.
Committed suicide. I mean, you've got so many phenomenal artists. Even look at Prince. That was an overdose too, you know?
Yeah.
Where artists, where it consumes their life and they don't know how to ventilate, they don't know how to aerate, and they're basically in the trenches, they can't communicate, and they start to self-medicate kind of thing. And music has that thing, and it's very same with athletes as well too, because they're performing at a particular pinnacle, I guess.
Yep.
And when I step up that pinnacle, for example, they lose direction, they lose that particular compass, I guess, that has grounded them, I guess, you know? But it's amazing how, you know, with the evolution of music, the evolution of the artist, but the evolution of the pecking order where you are within the music industry as an individual, that is.
Yeah. So what you're doing now then, so I mean you've got a lot of things really.
Yeah.
I mean, just the things you have done, like with the lunch on the Titanic. This was on your list, wasn't it, when you were young? Like the Titanic.
Yeah, well, I was 8 years of age, man.
Yeah.
I drafted the screenplay of my life.
Yeah.
You know, things like want to become a multimillionaire, you know, visit 100 countries and above, have lunch on the Titanic, become an astronaut, go to space,
yeah.
Climb the highest mountain in the world, run with the bulls in Pamplona. So I've done a lot of that. I mean, I got to have lunch on the Titanic. I did a halo jump off Mount Everest. I climbed the highest mountains. One of my guitars from my last gigs, I got to throw it into a live active volcano as it was erupting.
Pretty
awesome. Yeah. You know?
That's amazing.
You know, I've now been to about 150 countries.
Yeah.
I have businesses on about 5 different continents. Like I said, I've got a lot of businesses that I'm involved in, also as a strategic advisor. I have a Hollywood production company. We produce trailers for Hollywood businesses, and also producing one of my new TV shows.
Yeah.
But so a lot of fun, man. I'm not a busy person, but I'm always optimized. You know, it's like playing guitar. You got 12 notes. It's how you optimize and phrase with those particular notes. You know, I mean, you know, those notes in the wrong hands can sound very destructive. But those 12 notes with the right player, I mean, it's just most phenomenal musicality, I guess, if you want to call it.
Yeah.
But for me, it's always been the arts, I guess, you know. I mean, even as a keynote speaker, I was still on stage. Even though I left the music stage, I was still on stage as a keynote speaker. But then now I was naked without a guitar, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
But like I said, I mean, music, it's not something you can eradicate from your life. It will always be me. It's part of my DNA. Yep. Music is my DNA, just like music is part of the Apple DNA.
Yep.
My whole family was musical. My father was a successful musician back in the old country in Europe, I guess. But you know, my kids, even though I don't have any kids, I know they'll be musically inclined for sure, guaranteed.
So is there anything left on that list that you wrote when you were 8 that you haven't done yet?
Yeah, basically walking on the moon.
Ah.
But I have a contingency. I've already paid, well, in the event that it doesn't happen in my lifetime, which I think it will within the next 20, 30 years, I will walk on the moon for a fact. If something happens, if my life was to expire for whatever reason, I've already paid an American consortium to rock in my crematorial remains to the lunar surface of the moon.
Oh, really?
So it's in my will. I've already paid up. Which means my ashes will be placed in a capsule, rocketed to the lunar surface of the moon, and poof, explode on the lunar surface, and my ashes will remain there for eternity. Why? Because the moon has no rain, no atmosphere, meaning my ashes will remain there forever, which means my loved ones, wherever they are in the world, they'll always be able to see me, you know?
That's great. That's really good.
As opposed to like a traditional burial, for example.
Yeah.
This way, hold a glass of champagne and say, there you are.
I really like that. That's great. Really good. Yeah. So I know you have to go soon. You're on set at the moment.
We're just put down. We're filming out here in the desert, a place called the Badlands. Check this particular place out. So we found this crazy, crazy site, and it's got T-Rex dinosaur eggs.
Oh, really?
Like, we're talking about like this prehistoric area in the Badlands in New Mexico. It is just ridiculous. Mm. And we're basically just, I'll send you some photographs, but this place is absolutely wild.
Jeez.
But we've shot some amazing drone work there. Pretty cool.
Wow.
Pretty damn cool.
So with the new show, will that be on like Netflix or something like that?
Yeah, well, I can't announce who the networks are, but
That's right.
It's going to be, you know, the foreign rights are being sold right now around the world.
Yeah.
So it'll probably air in about 40, 50 different countries. But it's been an absolute buzz, man. I mean, it's been filmed in about probably 14 different countries so far. Really exotic, the most remote. The cinematography is beautiful.
Mm.
I mean, I go to great lengths to get the shot.
Yep.
And basically, it's, you know, an astronaut crash lands on Earth, and the viewer gets to observe Earth from the vantage point or perspective of a visitor. Yeah. And it's just a real interesting take on what encompasses Earth. Yep. You know, and we explore different themes, whether it's God or whether it's civilization, or whether it's inferno, volcanoes, or whether it's war, or whether it's speed, whether it's art, whether it's caves, you know. And we draw deep, all viewed from the lens of an astronaut. So pretty damn cool. And the footage is mesmerizing. It really is. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, but what I've seen, it looks fantastic. You know, I can't wait for the world to see it. It'd be unreal. No, it's been great. So, yeah, just finding out a little bit about yourself and the guitar side of things all those years ago, even now.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. My new book's called The 5-Day Weekend. How to solidify your foundation to life, you know?
Yep.
So you can spend more quality time with your family and your friends and more fun, more freedom, and more fulfillment.
Yep. Oh, that sounds great. All right. Thanks again, Nick.
Awesome, man. Hey, anytime, man. Cool. Cheers, buddy.
Thanks, Nick. See you later. Bye. So I hope you guys enjoyed the interview with Nick. Now, make sure you do get his book. He's actually got two books. He's got The Three in Air, which is a great read as well, and the new book, 5-Day Weekend, which you can actually pre-order now on his website. So just go to the links in my notes. So it's nickhallick.com. So go there, pre-order it. It's released in the next few weeks in America, and then in Australia it will be out in April. I really strongly recommend this book for anyone. I've actually gone through and highlighted some of the points that I've learned from the book, and it's nearly every page has got a highlighted little saying. Just some of the little things that I've highlighted in the book we can actually put into life and music. It really is for everyone. So things like this little quote: you don't invest in retirement. You eliminate retirement and choose to love your life. So you never fully retire. Instead, you retire from the things you hate and embrace living a life you love. I know for me personally, that really does reflect on my music and how I really like to do the things that I love, from teaching and some performing. I won't say all, but most of my performing. And also, another little tip from his little section called Freedom versus Security. So he goes on to say, when you work a 9-to-5 job, you're at the mercy of your employer. So they really do orchestrate how you spend your 8 hours each day, and sometimes longer. And they also have the power to fire you at any time. Now, another little saying is pretty much what sums up this book, is when Nick says that most people work for their money, but Nick is actually going to show you how to get your money working for you. So yeah, so please do check out this book. Like I said, it's changed my life a lot and my ways of thinking, and I hope it is good for everyone else too. And I look forward to that 5-day weekend coming up real soon. Now, if you'd like to know more about my previous podcast and the guests that have been on, go over to my website, becomeaguitaristtoday.com, all one word, becomeaguitaristtoday.com, and you'll be able to check out the videos in the gallery of all my artists that have been on, and you can check out my shop page and check out my different packages for guitar lessons as well. So once again, I'd really like to thank Nick Hallick for this great interview, and also for the guitar lessons back in the early 90s, and for the two books I've read, The Three in Air and The 5-Day Weekend. Now, in next week's podcast, I'm actually going to be answering some of the questions that I've had over the last couple of months. So I'm sorry I haven't got to everyone lately, but I've had a lot of interviews on, which has been great. So if you do have any other guitar-related questions, please do send me an email at adroach1@hotmail.com, and I'll be sure to answer it in next week's podcast. So, until next week, keep jamming.